You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good morning. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm going to be live in the studio with Phil Small of the Inland Northwest Permaculture Guild, and we will be talking about the upcoming permaculture convergence. What is permaculture all about? What are some of the symptoms it addresses, and how does it provide us a way to look to better ways of doing things? Basically, I think. Does that sound about right?
That sounds good. Yeah.
All right. So do you want to just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about how you got into the permaculture world?
Yeah. I moved to Spokane about 10 years ago, and I, living in the city, looking for better ways to grow a garden, better ways to interact with my new neighbors. And you come across permaculture, even if you've never heard of it. If you're looking for new ways to grow food and better ways to grow food, you find it on YouTube, you find it in discussion groups. And it turned out that there's a group of permies here in town. I actually had trouble meeting them, but this is kind of a funny story. But I had a business card. I'm a soil scientist, and I had given it to somebody. And they had apparently tossed it out in the Huckleberry's parking lot. And a permie picked it up and called me up and said, "Wow, soils, I need to talk to you." And he explained what he was doing. And I'm more agricultural soil science, and heard what he had to say. And I said, "Boy, I think you need to meet up with the permaculturist in town. I'm having trouble figuring out when they're meeting in the study groups because our schedule is such." And he said, "Oh, you're in luck. They're meeting today at 3 o'clock. He knew them.
Wow.
It's one of them. And so I went to that meeting, and it turned out it was the organizational meeting for the 2011 convergence. And so I got pulled in pretty quickly into permaculture at that point.
Cool. And for people listening who don't know, who have no idea what this word is we're talking about, what's your definition that you like to go by when you're explaining permaculture?
Well, my understanding really started out as it's a amalgam of approaches to growing food sustainably without a lot of chemical inputs, a lot of energy inputs, and excess irrigation if you can avoid it, and by working with ecosystem sciences, you're trying to fit what you're doing in your garden with what the natural cycles are. But I've come to understand it more as a larger body of knowledge that kind of informs our whole approach to solving problems as to how we live our lives, how we need to redesign our culture. Changes are coming. We're going to run out of petroleum and energy, and we've got a lot of skills based on an extractive economy, and permaculture is really looking to realign how we live when we won't have a lot of easy extraction of minerals and energy.
Yeah, and was that, so you studied soil science probably from the more, well, it's science, so it's objective, you know.
Yeah.
But were there a lot of people coming from a traditional agriculture background who you studied and learned with? Was that your frame of reference at first?
Yeah, certainly. I graduated from college, got my bachelor's in 1977, so this was right at the end of the Vietnam War. A lot of vets came back to college then, but there was also a lot of counterculture influences going on, so that was part of the background. But certainly the soil science I learned, and I learned more about how to map soils than to do agricultural soil science, although I've changed over the years. But I think even back in the 70s, there was a real interest in looking at the bigger picture. Unfortunately, you go to college and you get soils courses for 2 or 3 years. You can only get a very a caricature of what the true soil science is. And basically, it gives you the ability to learn based on that. And some people really did go into the agricultural aspects of it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I just know that the agriculture around here has taken a toll on a lot of the soil that we have, and those systems are all reliant on that fuel. So that's what you were talking about. And it's kind of scary if you think about it that way, but it's good to know that we have all these other tools in permaculture and other ways of doing things that are mostly old ways of doing things.
Yes. Yeah.
That are really coming back to the surface. So.
Yeah, I'm encouraged that agriculture is looking to permaculture. There's individuals who are deeply involved with traditional agriculture who have seen that there's things that can be learned from permaculture. I went to a presentation that the Conservation District promoted a year and a half ago, and that was to move green cover crops to polyculture cover crops, and the huge impact on increased soil health has really got people's attention. So there's hope, but it's moving very slowly. We need a much larger group of people involved in it.
Yeah. So would you say that this coming convergence, the not this coming weekend, but the one after, is that a good entry point for people who don't know much about it?
Yeah, that would be a really great way to get an introduction to the full depth of what permaculture can be.
Yeah. And so it's, let's see, it is at the Hartsong Retreat Center, which is out at Tum Tum, not really far at all from Spokane. If you're a Spokaneite listening, we kind of penetrate pretty far into Eastern Washington, but it's not too far for anyone. And it's Thursday through Sunday, the 11th through 14th. What are you most looking forward to?
Well, the people. I mean, it's really, you know, we, and this is true with any group of people, we spend most of our time working individually or in small groups, but really to get together once a year and re-energize, see what everybody's doing, what people have learned, new ways to present the ideas that we're developing. There's a lot happening.
Cool. So, and is it mostly going to be a workshop type of setup, or
there are
workshops.
Yeah.
That was a weird
there's
way to ask that.
Yeah, workshops on the schedule. With this is our fourth annual gathering. We've had the first one was in Spokane. There was one in Missoula, one in Hayden Lake, and this is the fourth one. And they've been very workshop centric, and we're trying to loosen up the schedule this time to create more open time for folks to interact and create smaller community groups to carry forward with.
Nice. That kind of fits right in, right? I mean, to as far as you've observed what's happened in the last years and how you're adapting to it. So let's talk maybe a little bit about the principles, you think?
Okay. Or
permaculture ethics and principles for people who don't know. There's an idea that I think has been kind of communicated into some sustainability circles or, green, these folks are into like green capitalism or whatever you want to call it, of the triple bottom line, which is a pretty similar to this idea of the three ethics being care of the earth, care of people, and fair share.
Thank you.
And those kind of get translated, but I like that it's the core of this system of looking at things beyond just gardening, which I like that you pointed that out earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But was that part of what attracted you to permaculture, this idea, or did all that come later?
Yeah,
after?
No, the social aspects are really important. And, you start out looking at the mechanistic parts and just, okay, how much sunlight, how much water, and those kinds of things. How much can I grow? Calories, mineral nutrition, and those sorts of things. But in the end, it really comes down to people. I mean, we are the resource that permaculture has the ability to harness. And it takes a really defined ethic once you start developing people systems. And so I really appreciate the thought and the insight that went into producing a set of design principles that really focus in on the person and on society. Permaculture has got, many of what we're looking, the problems that we're having are ethical and moral issues. And permaculture takes that on, tries to derive systems, points us towards creating systems that work with people and nature.
Mm-hmm. And do you, I know it's kind of likely a fairly insular community because it's niche at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, it's maybe countercultural still in a lot of ways because of what you mentioned there. I find myself frustrated talking to people about what I feel are the obvious failings of the systems we're operating with now. But people act as though there isn't another way to do it. Have you had success breaking through some of those psychological barriers, either with yourself or others?
Yeah, and I find that it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience. And in permaculture design, you know, we talk about the proper time to institute change. When do you start change? And you usually don't start change the first time that you meet somebody. There's an active listening process, and it takes years, months at least, to build trust with an individual that's going to change. But at some point, even though a person will be dead set on continuing the way that they're doing, and they have their reasons, at some point there's an opportunity for change when there's the system becomes upset. A lot of our agriculture is based on what the banker, what the lending institutes need from the farmer. And a farmer can't really change unless there's already an existing system to support that. I mean, they can't do it alone. And so we need to build that support system and train those bankers. And it's going to take generations to do some of this. It happens faster when there's crisis. And so in many ways, permaculture is positioning itself to be there when crisis happens and to help people respond to it.
Hmm. And do you think, I just think that's really interesting, that idea of observing people in a similar way to how you'd observe nature, basically. Do you think that carries through across the board? Does it hold true with people who are generations removed from living in a more balanced way with nature?
Yeah, I think in the big picture it does. You know, there are certain things in nature that you can't change, and you just have to flow around those obstacles. And decades ago, I heard a definition for that. Well, change happens one funeral at a time, and whether that's an actual, you know, death of a person or simply the death of an idea that just won't sustain itself. But it has to be obvious that that's where we're going before change happens. You really forced change and saying, I've got, you know, permaculture is the moral high ground. You need to cave into this and realize how bankrupt, you know, your Babylon system is. That's not going to work.
Yes, I've been observing that myself over the last few years. I've changed my tack a little bit on that. Going from being pretty aggressive about things to just can't really force it, but you can, like you said, you know, build something that's conducive to moving in a better direction. But
and so permaculture, we're trying to find like-minded people to work with and build that core, because as individual activists we can't be nearly as effective as we can in a group process.
Yeah. So I guess what is the goal for, in your mind, I mean, there's probably not total agreement on this within the community, but for growing permaculture and permaculture ideas beyond, you know, individual people's backyards, things like that, especially in a city.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there's a lot of cities are controversial in a permaculture context, and in our society in general. There's a real tension between folks who live in the country and folks who live in the city. The folks who live in the country say, you know, cities are not sustainable. They're going to go the way of the dinosaur. And those of us who live in the city say, wow, cities are here for natural reasons. I mean, we have a critical mass of thinkers. Many aspects of commerce and trade and exchanging ideas happens much more efficiently when you're in a group. And so there's a real place for cities, but changing a city as opposed to going out and buying 10 acres and changing that piece of ground is a really different problem to solve. And we see real opportunities in changing some cities. Some cities are located in really sweet parts of the landscape where there's plentiful water, power. We've got good soil, we've got good resources, and there's other cities, and you can tell that longer term they're just not because they're based on long distance transit of energy and resources. They don't have the advantages. So some cities are easier to design around, and I think Spokane and many cities in eastern Washington around the flanks of the Rockies and the Cascades are in a pretty good position to be here for thousands of years. And with that vision in mind, we know the city's going to be here in thousands of years. We just have to do what we can to steer it in a direction that's more sustainable.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I tend to not think of Spokane in those terms necessarily, but I mean, I was just reading something fascinating about Miami, which is literally sinking. I mean, it doesn't have a decade left in many ways. It's the sewage system is failing because seawater is backing up into it. And all the, you know, the politicians and the majority of people who live there are saying, nothing's wrong. This is fine. Let's just keep importing sand and everything will probably work out, you know. Yeah. So I wonder, it'll be interesting to see in the next 10 years or so as climate change unfolds more rapidly too. How different communities react and how we can help each other, really. Yeah. I mean, that's what's going to have to come down to.
Yeah.
I like to believe that people enjoy helping each other, so.
Yeah, it gets pretty boring otherwise.
Well, yeah, exactly. tell me a little bit about some speakers. There are some structured, some things planned in the Convergence. Who's going to be doing some of these presentations, and do I have your paper that you want?
No, okay. I've got this. Nice. So, our keynote speaker on Saturday has been working with Zep Holzer, which Zep is from Australia and has done some really magnificent things on the landscape, and we're all trying to learn from him. And Zach has been working with him for 3 years now, and so we're really interested to hear what he has to say, because Sep has opened our eyes to a grander scheme for earthworks, where we take a fairly a uniform slope and probably a low diversity of plants and induce diversity in the landform by putting swales on contour, building ponds, trying to hold the water and hold the solar energy and increased biomass productivity. And so Zep has done some pretty large scale works, and Hartsong is it's not a large site, it's 8 acres, but it has an area that just looks like it would be really nice to induce some of that complexity into the landscape. So not only will we be able to talk about it, we'll be able to walk on it and talk about the water and the sun on that site.
Wow.
That's very much looking forward to that.
Cool. So it's applied right then, not apply it later when you go home, but let's do it now.
Yeah.
Cool.
And we've got a lot of workshops, and Hartsong is a really great palette for the plant walks. We've got various people coming in. We're going to look at the existing plant diversity. And we've got some folks coming in who know polyculture as it applies to food forest. And so there's an existing orchard on the site, and there's also an area that we could start a new food forest, which is a polyculture of perennial plants. And we try and get as much diversity into the food forest as possible to support the fruiting trees, but also all the ecosystem services that you get in a diverse landscape. And so there's been a fair amount of training on food forest for our folks in the Northwest. Toby Hemenway came last year and gave a presentation in Spokane about that. There was a course in Helena last year that a number of us went to. And so we've got a kind of a critical mass of folks who are tuned in to the food forest aspect. And so that's going to be a draw, because there's folks not within permaculture but within the city of Spokane are really interested in installing community food forests. Food forests we'd share because they'd be in public spaces like parks. Hmm. And so that's moving forward. Looking forward to that. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing Gloria Flora speak. She's got a huge ox that she's going to bring. She just got this ox to help her and Mark up at Terra Flora up in Colville on their forested permaculture build. Mm-hmm. And this huge gentle ox. I'm really looking forward to seeing this.
So she's bringing the ox with
her.
She is
bringing the ox,
it's,
yeah.
It's not a huge drive. Cool.
Yeah.
So
that's that, now that's what I've heard. Moving an ox is,
that's
we'll
what
see.
I'm curious about. Yeah. Well, I'll have to go just to meet this ox. But yeah, and Gloria will probably be talking about, I'm assuming, some of her work with biochar, doing that, which I see that you also have a background in.
Yeah, I'm very interested in biochar, and I met Gloria 3 years ago in St. Regis when she was speaking there, and I'm so pleased that she's moved from Helena closer to Colville so that we can explore the Spokane is kind of a biochar hothouse of interest, and a lot of the folks at the Department of Ecology, Mark Fuchs, has got the biochar bug and helped to direct millions of dollars of research funding within the state of Washington, and now Mark is a sought-after expert on biochar the world over. And so we've got a critical mass of biochar things happening in Spokane, and Gloria is at the point of the spear of that as the head of the U.S. Biochar Initiative.
Can you explain to the layman in the audience what biochar is all about?
Yeah. So biochar is charcoal, but because we think of charcoal mainly as fuel or industrial, like activated charcoal, it was good to come up with a different brand to communicate that charcoal that's made with the intent of improving soil should have this brand. And we've seen great results with biochar added to soil in some cases. In some cases, we've added too much or not enough or haven't matched the charcoal type with the soil. So it's relatively complex, which I love, because simple things don't seem to attract me. I seem to attract real tar baby kinds of ideas that you just have to work through over the years. We rediscovered this in the Amazon. When I was learning, we were all taught that the Amazon was this terribly, terrible, infertile soil, and that that nobody could live in the Amazon, you know, in great numbers because the soils were so poor. Well, it turned out that people had improved the soil in pre-Columbian times with charcoal, vast amounts of charcoal, which means it took generations to build it up, and it took a corporate intent, a community intent to build those soils. And there are historical counts of huge numbers of people, huge population density that disappeared after disease came through and wiped them out. And now we've rediscovered those soils and realized that it's about 5% of the Amazon basin in the areas that are best conducive to supporting cities. That's where we see these charcoal improved soils. And so it's really caught us by surprise. When I was taught to map soils, I was taught to avoid all the charcoal in the soil as being unnatural, being an anomalous condition. And so it's this biochar is coming in through a blind spot. We've never been trained to look at it. And now we're finding that it has a hugely complex interaction with the soil. Soils have evolved over millions of years with charcoal being present. Healthy soils expect to have an active charcoal component in it. So it's a very exciting area, but it's so new that we've got a lot to work through in terms of educating ourselves and educating others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is not a permaculture way to ask this question. because obviously in natural systems, every piece is important. You know, mm-hmm. That's why it's a system, is because it's interreliant and interdependent. But I was going to ask you how important soil is compared to other things. But obviously soil is very important to us having a future.
Yeah, it's like an second nature. It's like, how important is air or sunlight or
water?
The interesting thing about soils is that there is no soil on the planet that hasn't been affected by people. So there's no natural, there's no pre-people natural soil. And soil reflects our impacts. Soils are us. And that is the perspective that as people realize that we're walking on our legacy, that the Greek civilization, and you go to Greece, they had a great civilization. You go there now and all the soils have eroded off. All those great vineyards that they had way up the valley sides, all those soil is eroded down to the rocks. And then they went to grazing systems, and the density of goats and sheep just added to that. And there's a lot of great civilizations that ended up eroding their soils. And you look at that, you know, multi-millennial legacy of what we've done to our soils, and then you look at the Palouse and look at the aerial photographs and see all the eroded subsoil exposed in those aerial photographs, and you realize that we have this habit, this cultural habit, of extracting the goodness out of soil, not just, you know, metals out of mines and extracted energy. We live on extracting soil, eroding soil, and that's going to change at some point.
Yeah, and that's mostly due to monocropping, right? I mean, largely it's due to growing wheat in the same place over and over again, or alfalfa, or you name it, corn.
Yeah, and it's a really slow process. I mean, the Greeks probably didn't realize that they're eroding their soils except when they had catastrophic events. And soil is something that you can build up over time. There's a lot of soil in the air, and with the right vegetation, you capture those silt particles and moving through the air.
Pull them back in.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, Graham. My lawn is 2 inches higher than when my house was built, because I'm on the lower south hill, and all the dust coming off the Palouse gets captured by the grass on my lawn. So my sidewalk is now 2 inches lower than my grass, because I'm building soil that other people have lost. So it's a natural process, and we can turn that around. Vegetation is really good at building up the organic matter and rejuvenating the life in soil.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's within our grasp to turn it around, but our system is kind of wired against it.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a perfect segue into talking about people who are not, you know, maybe don't garden or anything like that, are kind of in this paradigm that we're operating in right now. They're working a lot in an office, doing something abstract, not having a big tie to the planet, other than in total dependence, you know. But
yeah.
How can people, do you think, start to introduce some of these concepts and some of this work into their lives as we're still kind of on this boat? We kind of have one foot in, one foot out. How can people do that?
Everybody should be growing some herbs for their kitchen. Everybody should. It really comes down to how we eat, where we get our food, and what our relationship is with our food. I think that's where it starts. And you have a even if it's in a containerized plant on an apartment balcony, or going out and working on somebody, finding some neighbor who's got some soil and garden to work in, going to the farmer's market. It's really, the food is really the entry point for change.
Cool. And there are a lot of things happening there. You mentioned the food forest. I also saw that you're on the board of the Edible Tree Project.
Yes.
I want to have Kate in here sometime to talk about that and the rest. But do you want to just say a couple words about that too?
Yeah, the Edible Tree Project is a gleaning project, just started in the last year, but there's so many fruit trees in Spokane. We were so surprised. We knew there was quite a few, but then the city did a survey of what pears and apples they have growing just in the right-of-ways, and it's thousands of trees. And then driving around and seeing all the fruit left hanging last fall that hadn't been harvested, there is a huge amount of fruit that just doesn't get harvested because people are working so hard and involved with other things, and it's hard to get that time to be there right when the fruit is ready. And so folks have been really happy to allow us to come in with a group of people and harvest that fruit and take it to second harvest. And we've had some great conversations with folks, and we would like to use this also as an opportunity to teach homeowners how to prune, how to take care of trees. And as a permaculturist, you know, I'd like to see us talk about increasing the polyculture in yards. That opportunity is ahead of us someplace, but it's a great conversation to have with people in Spokane. Yeah.
And like you just said about your lawn, I mean, even if just your grass is capturing all of that lost topsoil, I imagine a polyculture would capture more.
Yeah.
Having a varied height and density of plants, and then it's not a net loss in the same way that it otherwise would be if it kept blowing through sidewalks and whatever else, you know, buildings.
Yeah.
And
end up caught by the street sweeper. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or in the stormwater drain and then into the river, which is not where we need it. Yeah. So great. So just for people who might just be joining us, I just noticed we're at the halfway mark. Shockingly, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm talking with Phil Small of the Inland Northwest Permaculture Guild about the upcoming September 11th through 14th Permaculture Convergence, the Inland Northwest Permaculture Convergence. There's also, I'm assuming there's similar gatherings around the country and the world.
Mm-hmm.
How widespread is the permaculture community?
Well, it's in every country, is, you know, effectively. It started in Australia and Tasmania, and it has spread since the 70s when it started. So it's had a lot of opportunity. I know there's been convergences in Nepal and Tibet, and it's pretty much everywhere.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Good. It's issues we have to deal with everywhere. So that's a plus.
Yeah.
And so in a lot, is it largely, are there a lot of people like you who have been on this continuum since the 70s? Since, like, are there a lot of back to the landers still involved doing permaculture, or?
Yeah, it's been a home for that mindset back from the 70s. And so you find a wide variety of age groups within the permaculture convergences, and you've got your old hippies, and you've got your very young people who are just coming into it. And there's also a wide variety of kind of political orientations. I mean, it's a very diverse group, and you have everything from folks who are very concerned about where the world is going, and, you know, we would call them preppers, survivalists, and they want to figure out how best to make their retreat workable within an ecosystem context. And then you have very urban social activist folks who are very interested in social justice and bringing everybody along, which are kind of two opposite perspectives on how to respond to the fears that we have about what the future holds. And I think what joins us all together is that permaculture is really a hopeful kind of perspective. There's a lot of dismal aspects to other perspectives, and permaculture really emphasizes, look, we've got the ability to change ourselves, and we've got the ability to have a garden. We can have the most influence right outside our kitchen door, and start there. And it's that's what really attracts me, is the hopefulness of permaculture.
And I wonder if gatherings like this help maybe pull some people who might be a little more motivated by their fear and wanting to protect just my family into realizing, oh, I could have this huge family of hundreds of people. So there's a sneaky, sneaky community building way of doing things. Not that it's sneaky. So I'm just going to read the 12 overarching principles, just so people know them,
mm-hmm.
Who are listening, if that's okay with you. And if you want to interject and give examples, or if you want to come back to a specific one, just let me know. So And these are all spread through those three, fair share, care of earth, care of people. So observe and interact, catch and store energy, obtain a yield, apply self-regulation and accept feedback, use and value renewable resources and services, produce no waste, design from patterns to details, integrate rather than segregate, use small and slow solutions, use and value diversity, use edges and value the marginal, and creatively use and respond to change. So those are all, they're largely different from, I think, some of the principles we're operating on in the, I don't even like to use we for that, but in that the culture that we're currently part of is operating on in the mainstream. But I don't know. Yeah, there's a couple I'd like to hear you expand on, if that's okay. The one I really like the idea of, my favorite, if I were to have a favorite, is about the using edges and valuing the marginal. What would a permaculturist mean by the edges?
Well, in an ecological sense, when you have a transition from one major ecosystem to another, right on the edge, there's some really interesting things that happen, and there's shelter there, and we as people, you know, we really like the edge. You know, you walk through the woods and you come out on a meadow, we always stop and look and take it in, and we sense that there's a lot of advantages happening right at the edge that you don't get in the middle of either of the other sections. And you see a lot of plant diversity happening there. And the it really, in what we try and do in permaculture is induce a lot of different edge types of scenarios with a lot of diversity that you can't have by just having individual sections of monoculture. By integrating the polycultures, every plant becomes an edge effect, so that you'll have different insects and different types of soil health processes going on within that complexity. So that's kind of code for induce as much complexity as you can. Mind-boggling complexity is a good thing. When you do that, you end up with things that don't work, and you set those aside, and you find things that do work, and you reproduce those patterns. There's a lot of pattern observation involved in permaculture, and there's been a Toby Hemingway has got patternliteracy.com as his website, and all of these principles involve detecting patterns that we see around us and learning to see them and learn to work with them. And that's, we come from a background where we're not necessarily trained to observe patterns in nature and patterns around us. We're learned to use recipes. We're trained to use formulas that other people have figured out and that we've validated for ourselves, but we're not necessarily trained to creatively look at the diversity around us. And there's so much more going on than what we could possibly have been trained by other people. So it's a very self-reliant, and these principles are really helping us to be self-contained, self-reliant pattern observers and pattern users, and then to join in a group and compare notes and accept feedback is a great principle. It's one of my favorites, one of my hardest ones to accept. I'm so used to being the scientist on the team that everybody else, I know soils, you guys don't, we have to do it this way. And the educational system kind of encourages you to have a big, fat ego, PhD type head. Which
somebody's in charge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to sit back and just be humble and go, oh my God, that's not going to, you're right. That's a fail.
Yeah.
That'll work for 5 years, but not after that.
So the accept feedback, I'd imagine is that mostly for people? Or is that also looking at what happens when you introduce a species? How do the other ones react, feedback
right
to
yeah.
it?
Yeah, if you try something and it ends up being all St. John's wort, not what you intended, that's nature's feedback is nature bats last.
Yeah.
You got to accept that.
Yeah. That's so you were talking about the observing patterns and how people are kind of wired to do more formulas. At the same time, I think we're also really, we are wired to look at nature and try to figure out what's going on. If you just think about the cliche of people talking about the weather, you know, I mean, that's, I make coffee for people and have a 5-minute interaction with many different people through the day when I'm at work. And that's a common, people want to look around and say, well, that's weird.
Yeah.
That's different from what's normally going on. And we don't get into a big science discussion most of the time. A few people want to. But I think people still have it. It's in the deep part of our human mind, understanding ability.
Yeah.
So that's a good sign. I think
we're survivors.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll see. We are. I think, I mean, we wouldn't still be here if we weren't, but
I have hope. I think we're always going to be here. There may only be a billion of us on the planet at some point. But I think we have a choice as to how we get to. We've got a huge population on the planet right now that's based on extraction of resources, and there's a question as to what our carrying capacity is without that, but I think it's pretty clear that it's lower. We can get there in a measured way. Our people die, people are born, we've got a lot of control over our birth rate and our death rate, and we can come down to that in a measured way, and we can come down to that in a pretty climactic way, and that's within our control, I think, and that's the permaculture principles are basically how to design that transition.
So creatively using and responding to change, right?
Yeah.
Because we're at a point, would you say this is, as far as global climate change in the context of a global civilization, basically is for all practical purposes, we're probably looking at the biggest change that humans have experienced.
Yeah, I think that's, for the whole planet, definitely. We've, glaciation was pretty big, but I think this is going to be bigger.
because that wasn't as widespread and people weren't interfacing with people on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, there's a lot fewer of us, and we just moved out of the way of those big ice sheets. And
most of us, some of us moved out of the way. Wow. Yeah. So it's exciting, right?
Yeah.
You're smiling
exciting.
Talking about
it is
that.
Exciting.
You're not looking, you don't have a look of dread or anything.
Yeah.
Because, if it's happening, we need to figure out how to deal, basically.
Yeah. It's we're part of nature. And what we've done to the planet in many ways is part of natural cycles. I mean, you can't really separate people from nature. That's an interesting theme within permaculture. There's a tension between us and native plant peoples because there's a native plant emphasis that we need to identify natural ecosystems and preserve them as much as possible because they provide so much ecosystem services. And the permaculture perspective is respectful of that, and we really want these active, relatively low interaction systems that we don't interact with a whole lot, so that they can preserve our watersheds and all that diversity. But we're also in tension because we really strive hard to find the most productive parts of the landscape. We really strive to find our allies within the plant and animal kingdom and create this community that we're a part of, a natural community that we're a part of. And so it's a different emphasis, and it creates a little bit of tension, and we in permaculture need to understand that there's this other perspective out there that we need to work with, be respectful of.
Well, and what you said earlier about people, about soils are us, and people influencing the soil. I mean, if that already happened, then that's a question for native plants folk to look at. The plants are still valued. The soil's still largely the same, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
But
it's just got some mercury in it that it didn't have before, and it's received soil that the Greeks lost to wind erosion, and
Yeah. So it's an ongoing flux, basically. Yeah. Cool. So let's pop on here one more time to talk about what people can, if people are interested in these topics, if people are wondering who are these hopeful people who want to befriend the soil and and all that. So this is a totally open to the public.
It is.
Type of.
It is, and this is the first time we've done it by donations. So you show up, and nobody will be turned away for lack of funds. We're suggesting a $40 donation, and it's very open. We're also hoping that people will be eager to volunteer their time, because it takes a lot of people to keep track of everything, move everything along. There's all these roles we need to fill, like the person who needs to walk around and make sure there's no fires starting, nobody smoking out of the designated areas, kind of a thing, on and on. The way the food works, we're a very food-centric group. Everybody is bringing produce from their gardens to share, and we've got a budget to buy, sacks of oatmeal and things like that. And we hire a chef. Derry is our chef, and he's our symphony director. Whatever shows up, he figures out what needs to be cooked today, what we can hold, and works out all the food aspect of it. Has worked really great when we've done this. And then within the whole context of the workshops, so we've got Michael Pilarski, who's taught many of us who have had permaculture design courses, been taught by Skeeter. Michael Pilarski. So he's going to lead us on several plant walks through the area. And Michael is so good with all the plants. I mean, he just has this encyclopedic mind of those. And then there's some other folks that are leading plant walks too. And and it's great to have a diversity of people doing it, because everybody has a little different perspective on what the plants do, how we interact with them, how they fit into the natural system. And Hartsong's a great place for plant walks. There's a lot of different types, ecotypes to walk through. Nice. Many of these presenters I haven't heard, and I'm really looking forward to hearing them. I haven't met Kelly Ware, although most permies in the area have, and she's very, she's very prolific podcaster and has got a lot to say, a lot to learn from Kelly. David Kirchhoff was in my class, and Deborah Williams are going to talk about indigenous architectural design, and really good to get that perspective. There's everything from plants to buildings to there's some spirituality and medicinal aspects.
Yeah, I saw that Carla Martinez is going to do an herbal healing. She's a local herbalist. Who I know. That's exciting. I'm hoping I can get out there. It looks like there's a lot of stuff planned for kids too. So
yes. Just
to clarify, it's a kid friendly, all ages.
It is.
Truly all ages type of arrangement.
Yeah.
Cool. And if people want to register or find out more, is there a website for them?
Yeah. Inland Northwest Permaculture.com. Yeah, there's registration on there, and we're encouraging people also to present if they have something. Let us know what your skills are, and the schedule's open, and we're trying to fit in as many small talks and get-togethers as we can within that schedule context.
Great. So, and if people can just come for one day, that's okay?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Whereas a lot of camping, it's not a site that's really built to have, there's not a lot of indoor facilities. So we're camping in camping tents and RVs. We've got a couple of houses. If people have special needs, we think we have room. And if it starts to rain, anybody who came without a tent, I think there's room in the what we call the barn to spread out on the floor, so we can handle that. There's not a lot of water at the site. If we pump the well, we start ending up with some iron water. So we're hoping people will bring water to help supplement that, bring firewood, bring food, bring 5-gallon buckets, bring chairs. I mean, it's kind of a joining of our resources at a place that would really appreciate if people kind come with a little bit of self-contained
equipment.
Cool. And that's in the spirit of permaculture in general, right? You'll see what you have, what you end up with, and make it work. I'm sure there's no safer group of people to end up around skills-wise.
Yeah, there's a lot of skills. Yeah. If something happens, there's a lot of people that can figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a trading circle set up, so daily we're hoping to spread the trading blanket. People will be able to trade for their wares, sell their wares. I know my friend who makes biochar kilns, I think I've got him coming for doing that. And there's, a lot of people have a lot of things that available to exchange.
Cool. And so in some ways it's a short-term model of how I'm sure a lot of permaculturists would prefer that our society run.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Yeah. It takes a certain skill set to feed a large group of people and get it all to work. Not a skill set that I have well developed individually. So I want to interact at all these levels to kind of build my community skills. And I'm great at a household level, not necessarily at a larger level anymore.
Cool. And, so do you think that larger communities like that are going to take a more central role as we move forward through all the stuff we're going to be moving forward through as humans?
I do. I think people realize, and I've started, maybe I'm projecting, but I've really come to realize that when something happens, like we had the big freeze in Spokane and electricity was off, I missed that, but things like that happen, and you need a trusted group of allies living close in enough to you that they don't have to jump in the car to get to you, who are concerned about you and that you're concerned about them. Oh my God, they're not going to have any power. Maybe I've got an extra generator. There's just that group intent to keep your group going. And those are the best units that a resilient community can have. If you can have a number of groups of people that are watching out for each other, that makes so much more sense than everybody rushing to the community center and saying, okay, I need blankets, I need food. And you need those kinds of community response abilities also. But without the small groups that are kind of self-organizing, it's much more effective with the small groups.
Mm-hmm. I found that really interesting. This might not seem relevant, but I hope it does to you. There's a huge amount of the cultural storytelling in the mainstream culture that's going on is around the end of the world in general, but zombies specifically. And the whole mythology tends to be around what you really have to worry about is the other humans.
Yeah.
And that's become a pervasive idea. But it's one that I will loudly reject at every opportunity, and it sounds like you probably would too.
Yeah.
People are wired to help each other, right?
That's right, yeah.
How, and outside, do you think there's good ways to show that and build that kind of community outside of emergencies?
Well, if we can self-identify where our boundaries are, because we're all uncomfortable around strangers. I mean, we're wired to protect ourselves and our loved ones from the unknown. And that's what zombies are, the unknown, obviously not to be trusted. And yet on the other side of the coin, we're wired to be very trustful because we're curious and you got those seeds to grow those. I mean, I don't know you from Adam, but what do you need to trade for those seeds? I mean, we just don't move forward without trust if we're self-contained. And that realization makes you want to investigate, okay, what boundaries are that I'm trying to use to protect myself are actually getting in the way of having beneficial interactions. And I think at some point people realize that they're being ridiculous. I'm going to get as many guns and ammo as possible, and I'm not going to worry about food because I'll be able to take it. You actually hear people saying that. And at one point, we're just appalled to hear that. But it's good for those people to say that out loud, because something in the back of their head is going to go, wow, I'm a complete, oh, what are the seven words I'm not supposed to say?
Anyone probably apply.
So it's good to encourage people to vocalize it, and I think that's how you grow, is you hear yourself and go, wow, I'm never going to say that again. You know, I think I just lost a friend saying that. That's
yeah. And also, and then providing support for people who realize they don't want to say that again, and giving them a chance to learn other things to say, learn, what skills they have. That's something that I want to make sure we get to actually in the last few minutes here. I see just in people I know and my own limited experience, I see permaculture being a really empowering thing for people. You mentioned the school system earlier, which I personally did not find empowering, and I know many other people don't, because it's about fitting into a structure. If you don't fit into it, then there's no place for you, and that's unfortunately the end of the story. With learning about ecology in general and seeing how nature works and how you need a little bit of everything to move forward, I think that's true in social ecology as well, you know. So have you seen that? Have you seen people really come into their own in this community and find their thing, find their niche?
Yeah. Spokane's a great place for that. Spokane's a very supportive place, and people can find their individual they can express themselves individually within the permaculture context that they weren't able to do outside of that context. And I love seeing that.
So we've got 3 minutes. Is there anything else you want to be sure that people know? Anything you want to share in those last couple minutes?
Great question. The permaculture community is really vibrant outside of the city of Spokane, and we love seeing that. The potential is for us to develop a much more vibrant permaculture community within the city, and I think that's going to happen. That's what I'm looking forward to here.
Cool. So one more time for people who didn't hear those details, the Inland Northwest Permaculture Guild's Back to the Roots 2014 Convergence at Heartsong Retreat Center, 7034 Highway 291, Tum Tum. You can find a map, I'm going to assume, at inlandnorthwestpermaculture.org, where you can find all this
.com.
Oh, .com.
There is a .org, so it's important.
Okay, .com.
Which is a great site also.
And I will share those links on my Facebook page and in the notes on this podcast, which you can find at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. You can also simply go to kyrs.org. And find the show page Praxis, and you can find those links there. And I'll also put it on Facebook, facebook.com/praxisradio, where I've also linked to the Inland Northwest Permaculture Guild's Facebook page. So it's a lot of, these are digital ecology map of links. So if people are interested, this is coming up Thursday, September 11th through Sunday, September 14th. Mm-hmm. Workshops and free time and plant walks and all kinds of permies out there at Tum Tum.
Yeah.
Learning and sharing.
It's going to be a great time.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining me on short notice.
Oh,
and
my pleasure.
Sharing what you know. And hopefully people out there got to learn something. And it's good for me on a internal level to have something hopeful on the show. I tend to get at problems and issues, and it's good to have a positive, concrete, solutions-based way to look at things. So,
all right.
Thanks.
Thank you, Taylor.
Yeah. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM, talking to Phil Small of the Inland Northwest Permaculture Guild. And I will be back live in the studio next week, Saturday. I mean, Monday, September 8th, I'll be here. And the fun drive is the following weeks after that. So stay tuned for that. We'll have some special stuff going on. Have a great rest of your Monday. Happy Labor Day. Hopefully people get the day off and be back next week. Thanks so much for listening.